All right, I got 9:29, but we're going to get started anyway because, as always, we got a lot to cover. So here's the plan for this morning. Last week, what did we talk about? Do you remember? Schism, the great East-West Schism of 1054, and it divided the church, Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and we saw last week that schism, that break lasted all the way till the 1970s and still really hasn't been fully healed. This morning, what I want us to do is look at kind of some of this happened before the schism, some of this happened during the schism and sort of ongoing carried through it. But we're looking more at the Western side of things, the Roman Catholic side of things, and looking at how the church was beginning to reform, how certain reforms were being done. Now, as Protestants, as the good Protestants we are, we tend to look at church history as there only ever being one major reform movement in the church, the big one, the Protestant Reformation. But what I want you to see this morning is that's not true. That centuries, over 500 years before Luther and Calvin and Zwingli entered the scene, there were brothers and sisters in the church who were actively working to reform some of the evils and the abuses that they saw taking place in the church. And so this morning we're going to look at two of them. We will start with what is called the Cluniac Revival. And so to understand, before we can really jump into the Cluniac Revival and everything that took place there, we need to step back and kind of enter their world, see what was happening and what kind of culture and worldview and struggles they were dealing with, because it impacts how the revival kind of took place. Now, in the world of Western Europe, around the year 1000, there was a group of people that plagued Christendom. They raped and pillaged and plundered. They were a force to be reckoned with, and they terrified the church. Any guesses on who I'm talking about? The Vikings, the Norsemen. The Norsemen were a group of seafaring people. They built these wonderful shallow boats that were able to move up rivers and into cities. They were terrifying people. They were also pagans. They worshipped the Norse gods and goddesses, and they hated Christianity. And so they attacked. And so what you had were a group of pagan warriors attacking Christian lands and Christian peoples and kings and lords and churches and burning it all to the ground and taking people as slaves. And so, I mean, and it plays out, this battle plays out differently in different countries, in different areas. So in England, for example, the Vikings, the Norsemen, and England forces fought violently for decades until a king of England, probably the first king of England, Alfred the Great, leads this war against the Vikings and defeats them. Alfred was a very devoted Christian. He viewed his position as given to him by God and saw the Vikings as a threat to the kingdom of God. And so he leads his men in this battle, but it's not just a battle of one nation versus another. It's a battle of one faith versus another. And Alfred overcomes and he defeats the Vikings in England, and they enter into a peace treaty. And part of that peace treaty, one of the requirements was that the Norse king be baptized as a Christian, which was uncommon at the time. This is slightly different from what Charlemagne and others did by holding a sword to someone's throat and say, be baptized or die. Because Alfred understood that if a Viking king accepted baptism, that him personally, he would be renouncing his pagan faith. And whether he became a full-fledged, faithful follower of Christ or not, the simple act of baptism was a turning away from paganism and an embracing of at least a Christian way of life. We see this also take place in France. In France, we had, again, more decades of battling the Norsemen and fighting and going back and forth. And eventually, France wins, and they concede a portion of the French kingdom and give it to the Norsemen. Any guesses on what part of the land they give to the Norsemen? Which, here's a hint, they called the Norsemen Normans. Normandy. So they give Normandy to the Normans. And then you also have Spain and Iceland and Denmark and Finland all have very similar stories. Wars with the Vikings, wars with the Norsemen, eventually winning and conquering, and whether it was through military battles with the sword or missionary efforts, gradually, over time, the Norsemen integrated themselves into Christendom. Also, in this world that we're coming into, the Holy Roman Empire, what countries started it? Who was the first Holy Roman Emperor? Charles the Great, or as we know him,
Charlemagne.
What country was Charlemagne a part of?
France.
So France starts back this Holy Roman Empire, but France quickly kind of falls apart. They get into these internal struggles over who should be king, and it's this battle of lords and nobles and everything else. And so France can no longer be relied upon to be the centerpiece of power and political structure in the Holy Roman Empire. At the same time that France is falling apart, another nation is actually rising and uniting and becoming stronger. That nation's Germany. And Germany is being united and led by a great king named King Otto the Great. You're only a great king if they call you the Great. And so Otto starts unifying his own nation and unifies it in such a way that the Pope, seeing the chaos taking place in France, looks at Otto's kingdom and says, he's the guy we need. And so Otto is crowned the new Holy Roman Emperor. And Otto did some things very uniquely at the time. And it sets the stage for what's coming. Otto ruled, and he used the church as a means of ruling. So what I mean by that is he would use bishops of the church and put them in government positions. He looked at the bishops and he said, the bishops are the most educated people in our nation. They're the ones who have schools. They're the ones who've been taught. They're the ones who read, who understand. They're the smart ones. And we need smart people serving in the government. And so he appointed bishops to serve in the government. But it wasn't like the secretary of the Treasury Department. It was, here's a piece of land in Germany. Bishop, this is now your land. You rule this land under my authority. And so the bishops actually became dukes and lords of the Holy Roman Empire. Bishops were also celibate. And so Otto looked at these bishops as the celibate, so no marriage, no family, no children, no heirs. And he looked at the bishops, having no heirs meant that if I appoint a bishop to rule this piece of land, when that bishop dies, I can then appoint a new bishop to rule the land. It's not going to be inherited. And so Otto saw this as this pervasive, ongoing control over his lands, because they weren't going to just be passed down to sons and future generations. The king always had control one generation later. And so what you have happening in this world is you have a church that is in control of the state. That is in the control of the state. The state controls the church. And this practice becomes widespread throughout the West. And in all of this, a new way of life, kind of a new dynamic of culture comes to power. We know it today as the feudal system. And the feudal system is this way of looking at the world where land becomes the single defining characteristic of political power. If you want a voice in society, if you want a voice, a say in the way things are done, the only way to get that voice is to have land. You have more land, you have more voice. You have less land, you have no voice. And so in order to sort of facilitate this, kings needed armies, they needed soldiers. And so what they would do is they would inscript men into their armies and they would say, in return for your service, I will give you this land. This land will be yours. It will belong to your descendants. It will be your protection, your little mini kingdom under my authority. And then all the people that live on the land, you can put them to work. They will serve you. You're responsible for keeping them safe and protecting them from violence, from invaders, all of it. We know the soldiers better today as knights. And so knights became this common practice. Charles Martel in the 7th or 8th century started this practice, but it spreads. And every kingdom has their own system of knights and lands and aristocracy. And so all of this sets up an impact, a very deep and lasting impact on the church. And what I mean by that is it was a practice, they adopted a practice called lay investiture. Anybody heard of this term before, lay investiture? So this is what it looks like. Let's say I'm a knight. I serve in the king's army, and he gives me a portion of land that becomes mine when I'm done fighting. I return home. I build up my land. I put the peasants to work. They work for me. I feed them. I protect them. I provide for them. And eventually we realize our land needs a local church. And so what I'm going to do, because it's my land, is I'm going to, at my own expense, I'm going to build a church. And because it's my land, that church needs a priest and needs a bishop. I just built the church. It's my church. And so I'm going to pick someone to be serving as the bishop. And I'm going to invest his authority from my own. You see the problem? What's the problem with this?
Control.
Who's in control of this?
The landowner.
The landowner. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Absolutely. Depends on the landowner. And so what you have, in part, you have, in the best case scenario, you have a landowner who looks at his land and his property and his little mini kingdom as given to him by God to rule justly and fairly and to care for the spiritual health of those that live on his land. And so he's going to want a healthy church. And a good theologian, a bishop who can serve and care for his people in the best way possible. And so in the best case scenario, he is building up a church and building up a local body of Christ. And the church is thriving under his protection and authority. And so what this does to the church on his land is it creates a sense of debt. We are thankful to our landowner. We are thankful for the blessings that he's given us. We're thankful for his protection, for his provision. We're thankful for the church that he has built us and for the bishop that he has given us. We owe him. And so it creates this sort of partnership between the bishop of the church and the guy who owns it. And all of this leads us to now better understand Cluny and the Cluniac Revival. Cluny is not a place. It's a monastery. Cluny is a monastery in southeastern France, and it was led by a series of phenomenal abbots who one after another just continued to lead the monastery in great ways. What the reforms, the movements that happened in Cluny have sparked not only church decor and beauty in worship, but also poetry and songs and hymns that have come from or been rooted in some of the stuff that came out of this Cluniac revival. The monks and the priests and the bishops related to Cluny all were devoted to holiness and beauty and piety and just elevating worship to a place of magnificence. When you entered into the monastery at Cluny for worship, it was you knew that you were leaving this earth and you were going to something better. It was all to point their worshipers heavenward. And it was beautiful and glorious. Things were so good at Cluny that they reformed things. They took away some of the abuses and the scandals and the laziness that had kind of pervaded some monasteries. And things become so good at Cluny that the Pope looks at Cluny and says, "You guys are doing such a good job. We want you to reform all the monasteries and we're giving you authority over them." This was brand new. A monastery was an independent thing. Whoever was the abbot of that monastery ruled that monastery and that monastery alone. But Cluny is unique in that the abbot of Cluny is now given authority over other monasteries and has the authority to reform and to change and to adjust things that are being done. Think of what we have today, like multi-site churches, where you have one center church and a bunch of other churches in the area that all kind of fall under the central church's authority. That's Cluny. Cluny is our first multi-site church, if you will. And so what happens is, sorry, I lost my place in my notes. What happens in Cluny is their idea is to reform and purify existing monasteries. They're not planting new monasteries. They're taking what's there and they're changing them, making them better. And Cluny all of these monasteries and churches are impacted in wonderful ways. They produce countless works of wonder and aid to worship. All of it's good. And the best part about Cluny was that it was totally free from all outside control. No politics, no fights with the state, no battles over who owns what land, none of it. Cluny was unique. It was independent. And everyone sees Cluny as a place of independence, and the popes support it because of the great work that they're doing. Despite their independence, the Cluniac monks begin to understand and to see their dukes and lords over the land that owned the monasteries as allies, as partners. And so Cluny develops this alliance between church and state. And not just an alliance, but a partnership in such a way that the Cluniac monks took the sons of the aristocracy. So if they lived on a land, they took the sons of their landowner and said, send us your children, we'll educate them and we'll raise them up and we'll teach them, we'll give them a solid Christian education. And then those sons grow up and they become kings and lords and dukes. And so now they look back on these Cluniac monks and say, what a great place that was. What a great time I had being raised there and being taught there. Let me work to support their ministry and build them up even more. And so you have this partnership, this alliance. But the kings didn't give away everything, give away their children in return for nothing. What actually happened in this partnership was that the kings benefited greatly from it. Cluniacs believed in the ideal of sacred kingship. What is sacred kingship? We've talked about it a little bit before. Any takers? Not that the king can do no wrong, but a king who's been appointed by God and rules in the, you remember the language of the vicar, the one who rules in the place of another. And so the king looked at himself, this ideal of sacred kingship was that the king ruled as the vicar of God and as the vicar of Christ. He wasn't just the king over the state, he was the king over the church and the king over the state. And it was his job, it was his spiritual duty to rule and to regulate not just his kingdom, but also the church within his kingdom. He was equal to the priest in church matters. Cluniacs looked at that and say, absolutely. We see the kings, this partnership that we've created and developed over time, this is a good thing. And we see our king as being sent from God and given by God and ruling in the authority of God. We submit to the king because he rules as the vicar of God and of Christ. Cluniacs also, with their heavy emphasis on education, they supplied the kingdom with great civil servants. If you were a man or a woman of means, you sent your children to Cluniac monasteries to be educated so that when they grew up, they could serve in a whole manner and host of different jobs and opportunities. And so the men who trained at these Cluniac monasteries often became bishops, and they often became government officials in addition to being a bishop. They carried out political and economic and diplomatic functions. And then the last benefit the kings received is that they received a huge army as a result of the Cluniac monks. Because it's their land. It's their people. And so in this alliance to the sacred king, the Cluniacs would send soldiers and send people to go and fight in support of the king who ruled and the vicar of God. And so all of this, the Cluniac revival, what it did is it unified society. It unified society with the church and the state working together in partnership. The monks educated and they led worship. Those that were educated by the monks served the state, doing so in honor of and to the glory of God. There's no line, there's no separation between church and state because both church and state are aimed at the same end, a Christian kingdom. But the problem with the Cluniac revival is that it was primarily local. This is not a church-wide, empire-wide thing. This plays out in local churches and local monasteries in small kingdoms. Nothing big. Which brings up the second of these two early reforms. involving Hildebrand and what's called the Hildebrandine Reform. That's a mouthful. Hildebrandine. So when Otto the Great, well, before we move on to Hildebrand, any questions on Cluny? Any thoughts? Any comments? So Hildebrand, while Otto the Great in Germany and Cluny is rebuilding, they're reforming things from a local perspective, the papacy is a mess. And I say mess very lightly. I mean, it is ugly. You've got popes who are known for their spiritual and moral decay. They're known for corruption. The pope becomes a political pawn. Because what happens in Rome is that the Roman aristocrats, the Roman landowners, are the ones who choose who's the pope. And so if they don't like the guy who's there, they replace him. And if they don't like that guy, they replace him. They replace him until they find a pope who can be bought. And they would fight over this and who would sit on the throne. It was nasty. I'll give you an example of this. In 1044, so 10 years before the great East-West Schism actually gets solidified, the pope at the time is a guy by the name of Benedict the Ninth. He is scandalously immoral. And everyone knows it. And so the people of Rome rebel against him. And they have a mob and it's violent and it's ugly. And they will not stop until Benedict the Ninth is no longer the pope. And so the aristocrats agree and they remove Benedict. And they replace him with a guy named Sylvester the Third. But Benedict has powerful allies in the Roman aristocracy. And they restore Benedict after he's been removed. Benedict sits back in power, but you know what? He gets tired of being the pope. So you know what? Here's something that he has, this papal seat, that is worth a lot of money. So he sells it. He puts it on the auction block and says, highest bidder gets to be the new pope. And he sells the pope to a guy named Gregory the Sixth. And so now Gregory the Sixth is the pope. But you know what? Benedict changes his mind and says, you know what? I kind of like being pope. I want to be pope again. And so he becomes pope again. And all of this sort of plays out when the Holy Roman Empire, one of Otto's children, Henry III, he arrives in Rome to be crowned the new Holy Roman Emperor, and he gets there and he walks into Rome and he says, I'm here to meet the Pope. And you've got Sylvester who goes, well, that's me. And Gregory goes, yeah, me too. And Benedict says, yeah, me three. And you have all three popes looking at him like, which one do you want us to crown you? It's a mess. But Henry III is a good emperor. He is a product of Cluny. He has been trained by the Cluniac monks. He understands the importance of holiness and devotion and piety. He is just and wise as a ruler. And he is a dedicated Christian who believes that the church should be better than it had been. And so he calls a synod. And he deposes all three popes. And he replaces replaces a better pope on the throne, a guy by the name of Clement II. This act of removing three popes and putting a new one on has been known as the cleansing of the papacy. And it begins this huge reform movement in the Catholic Church, primarily in the leadership of the Catholic Church. There are many major figures involved in this reform, but the central figure is a guy named Hildebrand. Hildebrand and others saw the papacy as the leadership of the church. And therefore, the pope should strive for the highest ideals of purity and holiness and morality. The pope should be the one who sets the example for the rest of the church. But they also saw how the papacy had been corrupted by outside forces. This wasn't just an internal struggle that we just picked the wrong guy a couple times. It was outside forces and other kingdoms and aristocrats who were influencing the pope. And so he said, we gotta be done with this. They wanted to make the pope free, even of the power of the emperor, so that the church can work for its own spiritual purposes and not the purposes of the state. And so what happens when you have this constant battle that we've seen now for generations, for hundreds of years, between church and state, and who's really in charge? And Cluny says, well, it's a partnership, but the king's the one who's in charge. And now you have Hildebrand saying, no, it can't be that way. And so you've got these two powers, these two people fighting for who's supremely in charge of the world. And the Hildebrand movement says, it's the church or it's nothing. And they elevate the Pope to such a extent that not even the Holy Roman Emperor has a say over the Pope. The Pope is the one who's supreme on earth. They see the Pope as being the greatest source of authority on earth above every earthly ruler, and the Pope and the Pope alone has authority over every local church. It's this version of the papacy that the Protestant reformers knew, and it's this version of the papacy that we know today. It is under Hildebrand's reform that we have the College of Cardinals. They're the one who, Hildebrand and his friends are the ones who form the College of Cardinals in deciding who gets to be the next pope. It's why they lock themselves in a room and they don't come out until a decision has been made, because they don't want any outside influence affecting the decision. No aristocracy, no emperor is going to decide who should be leading the church. They also, the Hildebrand reforms also wanted to purify the clergy, the local priests, the local bishops, who they saw as being purchasable and sexually immoral. So the purchasable issue is real. I mean, if a guy can sell the papal throne, then surely a local priesthood and a bishop's seat could also be sold, and it was. If you didn't want to be bishop, or if you would rather have money in your pocket instead of the responsibilities of leading a church, you sold it. And whoever wanted to be it could buy it from you. And it happened repeatedly. Hildebrand said, no more. We're done with this. But he also saw the clergy as sexually immoral, which is a big problem. Even today, if a pastor is sexually immoral, he shouldn't be a pastor. But there's a problem, is that Hildebrand didn't see what Hildebrand saw as sexually immoral, we see today as marriage. He saw priests getting married and having kids, and he said that's a problem. Priests should only be married to one thing, and that should be Christ, not having a family. And so Hildebrand's the one who, in his Reformation, who's the one who makes it blanket wide across the Roman Catholic Church that no priest can be married. Your marriage as a priest is to Christ, is to the church. You need to be free of the worldly distractions of a spouse and children, so that you can give everything you have solely to the church. He wanted the priest to function like a monk. It was also partly a desire to stop this inheritance that had been happening, where you had a long-term bishop who had sat in his seat as bishop for years and years and years, and then when he dies, he passes the seat on to his son, regardless of whether that son is qualified or not to hold the position. It's his, he passes it on. It's kind of like a piece of property. It's his inheritance. And Hildebrand says, no, we can't have that. That needs to stop. And he's right. Should positions in the church be inherited?
Not mindlessly.
I mean, I can point to several examples where a father was the pastor of the same church for years and years and years, and that when that father dies, eventually that son, his son, takes over the church. Isn't that a bad thing? Depends on the person. I agree. Hildebrand saw it as an issue altogether. Can't have it. Can't happen. None of it. Hildebrand eventually becomes pope. And Hildebrand's papacy has positives, has good things, has its negatives. Hildebrand's not a very tall man. He's short stature. He's got a quiet voice, but he's very persuasive. I think one of his contemporaries, he said this and meant it positively. I don't know that I would take it as positively as he said it, but he called Hildebrand a holy Satan. That he was able to persuade and to convince people to see things from his own perspective. And he was able to take even his fiercest opponents and bring them to his side. Hildebrand sees life as, he views all of life in military terms. Before Hildebrand, the church, when we talked about the church on earth and the church in heaven, they saw the church on earth as the pilgrim church, and they saw the church in heaven as the church at rest. And so you have this imagery of Christians and saints walking through life on earth as pilgrims, like think Pilgrim Progress, making the journey from the city of destruction to the celestial city. And then when you finally get to heaven, you're now at rest. No more traveling. You've reached it. You've made it. Hildebrand sees things differently. And it's under Hildebrand's changes and language that eventually the church begins referring to Christians on the earth as the church militant. What's the idea? What's the connotations of this language?
Today we would say Christian soldiers, right? And like it's kind of like progressive that same way. Yeah. We're doing battle against the forces of Satan.
Right.
The world.
And so if the church militant is the church here on earth, the church in heaven is the church victorious. You've won the battle. And so if you're the church militant, and if this idea carries a connotation of fighting a battle, you got to have somebody to fight. Who does Hildebrand see as the bad guy, the evil that the church must fight? Not Islam. Who's the church constantly fighting with for power? What, the government, the state. And so Hildebrand sees this the church as this beacon of light. We are the good guys. The state, the government, the emperor, the kings, they're the bad guys. And it's up to us to fight against them and to restore, to bring them under our control so that we can be a cause for light. What's the problem? What possible issues could come from this? What's that? No. You're telling everyone that the bad guy is your king. You got to fight against him until he bends the knee to the Pope, who's also a king. One of the things that Hildebrand's most known for is he issues a papal decree, which wasn't uncommon. But some of the things that he says are, you'll recognize them as things that we tend to think of when we think of the Pope today. These things were not new to Hildebrand. He didn't come up with them. He's just the first guy to put it in writing and make it official. Here, let me just read you a few of the highlights of this papal decree. He says this: the Roman Church was founded by God alone. Why does that matter? Takes away from the state, but also, what about those Eastern Orthodox guys? It's just a little jab that he can throw across to the East. He says, only the Roman Pope is rightly called universal. He says, only the Pope alone can depose and reinstate bishops. The Pope is the only one whose feet all princes must kiss. What's he saying there? The Pope is the king. He's the authority. He says the Pope may depose emperors. If the Pope doesn't like the job the emperor is doing, the Pope's the one who can kick him off the throne. Yeah, good luck with that. We'll come back to that in a minute. Remember this. He says no council can be called ecumenical without the Pope's authority. So if a church gets together and says we need to figure out a theological issue, and it only really concerns our area of churches, an issue that we're facing, we don't see it facing anywhere else, let's have a council. The Pope says, well, you didn't get my say-so. It doesn't count. It's not a real council. The decisions you made, the agreements you came to, they don't matter because I wasn't there. Here's the kicker. These last two or three. The Pope may be judged by no one. The Roman Church has never erred, and it shall never err for all eternity. And then the last one, whoever is not in conformity with the Roman Church cannot be considered a Catholic, which is Hildebrand's way of saying, you're not a Christian. Sound familiar? This is the Pope that we know. This is the theology of the Pope, the papacy that we know today. It's the Pope that Martin Luther and John Calvin and Ulrich Zwingli rebelled against. It's also why, hear me on this and just consider this. The reforms of Cluny and the reforms of Hildebrand are not all that different from the reforms that Luther and Calvin and Zwingli tried to do. Luther and Calvin, they never wanted to break from the church. They never wanted to separate and say, we're starting our own thing. But because of guys like Hildebrand who said, you can't question the Pope. The Pope's not wrong about anything. The Roman Church is not wrong about anything and never has been and never will be. You've got a guy, a monk in Germany who steps up and says, I kind of think the Pope made a mistake. And he will not be heard because the Pope can't be wrong. And so you have in these reforms, things setting up, especially from Hildebrand, setting up for what's coming in about 500 years. Hildebrand, in making these reforms, it's an uphill battle in a lot of ways. He puts an end to lay investiture, that whole practice where kings could appoint bishops. He says, no, no, no. Kings don't have authority to appoint bishops. Only the Pope has authority to appoint bishops. And he puts an end to it. And he actually, because of this, the emperor pushes back and says, no, I'm going to appoint bishops in my own land. You don't even live here. You don't get to decide who gets to be bishop here. And so they have this, again, church and state fighting for power. Who's really in charge? And it plays out in a very hard way, as you can imagine. The emperor defies the Pope and he appoints his own bishop. The Pope then responds and says, well, I'm excommunicating you. You're no longer the emperor. And what happens is the emperor's closest allies are German bishops. And they side with the Pope. Because the Pope doesn't make mistakes. And so, as the German bishops side with the emperor, that means that the army of the emperor also sides with the Pope. And so in a matter of with a single stroke of a pen from the Pope, the Holy Roman Emperor loses his army, his authority, his power, his kingdom. Gone, because the Pope said so. And so the German bishops get together with the help of the Pope and they appoint a new emperor. And Henry is desperate. So desperate, in fact, that he travels with his wife and children from Germany down into Italy and comes to the castle where Hildebrand, the Pope, is currently residing. And for 3 days in January, Henry, the former Holy Roman Emperor, stands with his wife and his children at the castle gates, barefoot in the snow, pleading for the Pope's forgiveness, for offering his repentance, saying he's sorry, please bring me back. And the reason it takes 3 days is because Hildebrand's not sure that he can trust him. On the one hand, showing grace, giving forgiveness, is certainly a good Christian thing that a pope should do. But on the other, if you restore Henry to power, what happens if he uses it against you? And so at the behest of his advisors, Hildebrand accepts the apology, accepts Henry's repentance, and restores him. Says, go be emperor again. You've earned it. We're with you. We're supporting you. Go do your best. Henry gets back, gathers his army, and marches straight to Italy. They destroy Rome. They commit horrible, outrageous things against the people of the city on their way to capture the Pope. And they succeed. They come in, they destroy the city, and they capture Hildebrand, and they send him into exile where he dies in 1085. His last words recorded were, I have loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore, I have died in exile. He says, because I like what's good, because I hate what is evil, I've been exiled and I'm going to die here. Question. On Hildebrand. Yeah.
Did Hildebrand make a mistake in
reinstating
Henry?
Yes, no, maybe so. Right, like, it's an issue, right? Like, Hildebrand knows it. He knows that it's a problem. But he does it anyway because you're supposed to be gracious. Right? There is that whole thing about Jesus saying, if he takes your cloak, give him your other one. If he slaps you on the cheek, give him your other cheek. But the reality is here's the lasting impacts of these two reforms. Cluny has a desire for a Christian kingdom. They see the world working best as a partnership between the kings and the church to bring about a world that is ruled by God. It's not a bad thing, is it? But where they went too far was that they handed over the authority of the church to the state. And they said, you tell us what to do. You put bishops in charge of churches. You do this. And we'll serve you and we'll give everything that we have to the benefit and to the blessing of your kingdom. Because what if a king or a lord puts people in church leadership that are unqualified? What if nepotism runs the day? What if favors are handed out? All of this can come from this. Hildebrand, his desire is for the church leadership to be pure, to be devoted to Christ. Not a bad thing. But he takes it too far in that he elevates the church above the state. It's the Pope who rules, not the king. I mean, the absolute authority that Hildebrand establishes in the papacy cannot be defied. It cannot be questioned. It cannot be ever doubted in any way. To defy the Pope is to defy Christ, according to Hildebrand.
How is the Pope?
The College of Cardinals. So the College of Cardinals would lock themselves in a room and they would decide who would be the next Pope, just like they do today. But, as Hildebrand's death testifies, it's hard to defend the position of absolute authority if you don't have a military to back it up. All it takes is someone with a bigger stick to walk into the room and say, you're no longer in charge. But the biggest issue surrounding these two reforms, how do the church and state work together? How do they fit? Who's in charge? And eventually this debate manifests into court cases. If a priest commits a crime, who decides what to do with him? Is it the church or the state? And this debate gets so intense that in England, you have a king of England who's arguing for every priest should be subject to civil courts. And you have an Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket, who says, no priest is ever going to be tried in the courts. And things get so out of hand that the king gets so enraged at one point that he says, In a closed room full of his closest friends and advisors, he says, I wish someone would just go get rid of that troublemaker Becket. And four of his knights, hearing their king make a wish, say to their faithful and loyal king, your wish is our command. And four knights march into the Canterbury Cathedral. They grab Thomas A. Becket in the church. They kill him on the altar and smash his skull open in front of the church. It becomes such an outrageous thing. People are so shocked that the shrine that is built at Canterbury to Thomas Becket becomes the single biggest shrine to anyone in the church. People come from miles away to see the place where Becket was martyred. And so the question remains, how do the church and state work together? How do they settle differences? How do they cooperate? Who has ultimate authority? If only God would tell us. If only we had someone like Jesus who could say something to the effect of, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. If only. Questions? Comments?
It reminds me a lot of Judges.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's a mess.
Was it all about power and control, or was there theonomy?
I think you had a theonomy mindset, especially among the Cluniacs, right? Like they wanted a theonomy, but they saw the king as being the leader of the theonomy, not the pope. And so the Hildebrand side of things would have seen it the other way around. But I can't say for certain that this was all a power struggle, but what we can say is the power struggle came as a result. Right? So whether Hildebrand saw it as, I want to be the one in charge, or if he just thought, hey, I think the Pope should be important. The fact is that what he did and the reforms he made actually said the Pope should be the one in charge.
I think the fear of opposition is the main problem. Mm.
Other questions?
I know they just released a decision this week. I saw a lot of discussion about it where the IRS says nonprofit churches can now endorse political candidates.
I saw that too.
And I heard, I read some people talking how they thought that was wonderful. I'm thinking, no, that's horrible.
It's a mess.
Just preach the gospel.
Yeah, it's a mess.
Get out of civilians' affairs.
It's Clooney all over again. Only. If only. It's good. All right. I've gone over. I'm out of time. Thanks for coming.